Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and glad to have you with us. You're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we'll talk about bills being considered by state and federal lawmakers this session. Plus, we'll hear from Enbridge Energy and community members in the Shawmigan Bay area about meetings this week related to the company's pipelines. But first, we begin with reaction this week to Governor Scott Walker's State of the State speech on Tuesday. In it, Walker outlined plans to cut tuition costs for in-state residents at UW system schools. He also said his next budget would include increases in local transportation aids and public school funding. The governor received standing ovations from lawmakers at times for his plans and reflections on the state's lowest unemployment rate in 15 years. I spoke with Delta Democrat Senator Janet Buley yesterday to get her take on the governor's State of the State.
Well, I think that, you know, we can certainly talk about the proposal to cut tuition, but is that the state of the state? I mean, of all of the things we can be talking about in Wisconsin, what is it that Scott Walker has left with us? How do we feel about our state? How do the people of northern Wisconsin feel about their lives in Wisconsin and under this administration? And I think people were listening for something that would resound in them to give them hope for the future, to believe that there's, you know, better days ahead. And I didn't get that. I didn't hear anything in what the governor had to say that would have the people of northern Wisconsin believe that we are going to get our roads repaired, our schools funded, that we are going to have broadband, cell phone accessible. I wanted to have an uplifting message, and we got some dribs and drabs about, you know, employment data and a tuition cut, and that was it. I'm pleased about the tuition cut, especially if he finds a way to fund it. But if he funds the tuition cut, that's taking money from somewhere else, and I'd like to see where the money's coming from, because he's not projecting any new revenue. So it was a tepid state of the state. I would have hoped for more positive message for the people of northern Wisconsin.
As far as the investment in some of the things that you outlined, broadband and cell coverage and infrastructure, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, he did say that there's going to be more money, $35 million in broadband, and I want to see where that goes, if it really is deployed in the areas that need it the most. But the big, big question, of course, is funding for transportation in our schools. He did not talk about what he's going to do. It was left kind of up in the air. I felt a little bit of, I was unsure. I was left feeling unsure about what he has in mind for Wisconsin when it comes to our roads. And I can only imagine that the people of Wisconsin would feel as unsettled as I did, because I do not know how he is going to repair our roads and keep our highways safe.
Well, and you're right in that he did not provide specifics, but he seemed to hint that because we would see economic growth, that there would be more money coming into the state through tax revenues, or that taxes have gone down, and that that in some way would help pay for a tuition cut or some of the things that he's hinting at, but not...
Just in what you're saying, he's hinting at... maybe there'll be a better economy with more revenue. That's not how you build a budget. You don't build a budget on hints and maybes and hopefully. You determine what kind of revenue you're going to receive based on, you know, what a gas tax is, or what, you know, whatever it is the revenues are going to be, and then you plan what roads you're going to fix. And he did not say how he is going to pay for the roads, which leads us to assume that perhaps he will borrow. And I know that the people of Wisconsin have been saying, and the people, the Republicans have said for years and years, no more debt, no more borrowing. But in fact, that's the large gray area that seems to be the answer to the problem for Governor Scott Walker.
Well, and when I spoke with you and Senator Tiffany on Monday of this week, Senator Tiffany mentioned some of the bills that he had in mind to propose during the budget session, including repealing a mining moratorium law, a bill brought back for aquaculture, and some other priorities. Do you have bills or proposals that you're planning to introduce? Are you staying strictly focused on the budget?
Right now, we've got to keep our eyes on the budget, because that is exactly where the values of the state of Wisconsin are going to be found. And if we were to introduce other bills right now, they would not be considered anyway. So it would be a distraction. I always have time for people to call and talk to me about issues that concern them. I always want to have constituents know that they can have their problems addressed by calling my office. But this is not the time when I'm going to go out with bills to introduce a bill. We need to get the budget done. That is what we do at this time in the session, is we set our budget and then we go forward with legislation.
You know, like you said before, too, earlier, that Walker was thin on specifics, and that we're going to learn more as information comes out in his budget address sometime in February. Do you think that there will be big proposals that will shock people on either side of the aisle, like the last year with some of the cuts that we saw?
Well, I think if you look back on the other state of the state addresses that he has given, what he says in the state is rather bland. It's rather pro forma. And then the budget comes out, and all the stuff is in there. We do not know for real what he's going to do until we see it in the budget. And I don't know what's going to be in there. I really don't. He has some problems there. The transportation problem, school funding is very critical. And Medicare and Medicaid. We've got to figure out what the Medicaid reimbursement is going to be so that people can have a good quality of life. And I'm waiting. I'm just waiting to see what he does.
Well, and not only those problems, but also, you know, your Democratic colleagues in the legislature, Representative Schilling, and I believe Peter Barca also pointed out that, you know, he didn't say anything about some of the problems that we've seen at Lincoln Hills and the veterans' home at King.
Right. And again, you know, when the governor gives a state of the state, we would expect that he would be talking thoroughly about how the state is doing now and what he hopes for the future. And I did not get an overall picture of how the state is doing in all areas. He did not talk about corrections. He did not talk about veterans. And he did not talk about what he hopes for the future, better roads, better schools. You know, there was no vision for what Wisconsin could be. And people need leadership. They need to know that the state is going in the right direction and that the people of Wisconsin are going along with it, that our lives are going to be made better.
Again, that was Delta Democrat Senator Janet Bewley, and we reached out to both Bewley and Hazelhurst Republican Senator Tom Tiffany for reaction to the governor's State of the State speech. We were unable to connect with Senator Tiffany on his reaction, but I did speak to the Northern Wisconsin lawmaker on Monday about his plans to introduce a bill to repeal the state's mining moratorium law. The law received bipartisan support when it was signed in 1998 by Governor Tommy Thompson. It requires mining companies to prove that a non-ferrous or sulfide mine can be run and closed without doing any environmental harm. Tiffany outlines why he thinks the law is no longer necessary.
Yeah, I'm expecting to introduce legislation to do that. And I thought it was very important early in the session here to let people know the various pieces of legislation that I'm looking at introducing. A couple of them, at least the ones that I know that I'm going to introduce. One is the Homeowners Bill of Rights. We're also going to introduce an aquaculture bill that failed at the end of the last session. But also, repeal of the mining moratorium is another bill that I'm strongly considering introducing. And I expect that to happen in the next month. And I think it's important for people to know what my intentions are as far as the legislation I'll be introducing.
Okay. And, you know, during the time when Go Get Taconite was pursuing an iron mine in northern Wisconsin, I want to say that, you know, there was discussion that ensued as part of, you know, the new iron mining law that, you know, as part of that justification, it was saying, you know, we're not touching sulfide mining at all or anything like that, non-ferrous minerals. We're keeping it focused to iron mining. So is this kind of a reversal of what you had said before, or what's driving this now, I guess?
Yeah, I don't view it that way. What has changed is the court case, the appellate court case at the federal level that was decided a few years ago. And I can't remember if that court case was concurrent with what we were doing on the iron mining legislation at that point, but it had not been settled. First, there was the case that Judge Crabb ruled on, where she said that Flambeau Mine, the Flambeau Mining Company, had done an exemplary job of closure of the Ladysmith mine. And she just left one little crack in the door where she said this one thing, I believe it was called Stream C, to use some technical jargon, that maybe could have been a little bit better. But otherwise, she said this is just an exemplary job that they did of closure of the mine. Well, it was appealed to the federal appellate level, and they said there is no doubt that they did an exemplary job and there are no problems with this mine. So in other words, by doing that, the courts said that there had been the closure of a mine for over 10 years that had there were no emissions coming from. That satisfies the mining moratorium law that was passed in the late 90s. And as a result of the law being satisfied, it really becomes, you know, the law, to because it's satisfied, it's largely irrelevant now. And if that's the case, then we should simply take it off from the books.
Okay. And I was just curious because, you know, I haven't done as much research on the mining moratorium law, but was it that it had to be closed successfully for 10 years, or it had to be operated successfully for 10 years and closed successfully for 10 years?
I think your recollection is correct that it had to be, a mine both had to be open for 10 years and closed for 10 years. Now, the Flambeau mine was not open for 10 years, but it was run successfully. But what I hear from constituents is the main thing they're concerned about is they don't want to have problems in the future. They want to make sure there is not environmental degradation in the future. And the Flambeau mine clearly has met that standard. And as a result, I think the law is, you know, has largely become moot at this point. It has been satisfied.
Okay. And are you hearing any interest, or have any companies approached you with interest in looking at some of these sulfide deposits like Culper, lead, zinc, things like that?
I have had no one come to me with specific deposits in mind, you know, different than the GTAC proposal, which was for a very specific deposit up in Iron and Ashland counties. This, there's been no specific proposals or any companies coming to me and saying, hey, we would like to open a particular deposit. Nothing like that has happened. I just fundamentally disagree with moratoria. I believe that we should have the proper permitting processes in place to be able to handle things like this. That's what we need to do. And I mean, we have a very strong sulfide mining law here in the state of Wisconsin. We should use it.
Okay. So nothing specific at the time, but you feel like there's opportunity that might exist in the future where companies would take advantage of that if this law were repealed?
Yeah, all you got to do is look at our neighbors to the east and west, Michigan and Minnesota, very successful mining industries. We have many of the same types of deposits here in Wisconsin. It should be a part of the things we can do for economic development. And if we're not going to allow things like mining, then northern Wisconsin is going to suffer. We are never going to reach our economic potential. Plus, look at the news over the weekend where Fiat Chrysler announced they're going to invest $1 billion in car plants in the Great Lakes states here. We should be producing some of those raw materials that make those automobiles as well as other manufactured goods. We should produce some of that right here in the Great Lakes states because we'll have a greater chance to have those manufacturing facilities right here in the heartland of the United States. If we don't, we're going to continue. I mean, look at Australia probably has the lowest cost producing iron mine in the world. It gives Southeast Asia and China a leg up on us when they have the raw material being produced right in their backyard. We should be doing some of that here in the Great Lakes states also, because we're going to have a better chance then to have that manufacturing going on right here in our backyard in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes states.
And what about the regulatory framework? You know, if even if this law would be repealed, you know, I know that you've voiced concern with some of the process and how things are permitted, whether it's at the state or federal level. And are you confident then that, you know, with the new administration coming in, that there might be, more reasonable timeline or more reasonable regulations related to mining?
You're referring to the federal administration?
Yeah, I mean, because we're seeing changes now with what? Scott Pruitt's coming in as the head of the EPA. And, under the Trump administration, do you see it being more favorable to development like this or taking advantage of mineral resources?
Yeah, I wouldn't say more favorable. I would just say I believe we're going to see science-based decisions coming out of the new administration with Secretary-elect Pruitt. I sure hope that he is approved because we need to get back to science. For example, you go over to Michigan, there's a deposit that's being mined currently that the EPA unnecessarily shut down a road from the mine site to the processing facility. The company is having to truck that ore twice as far as they would if this road would have been permitted. The road was permitted by Marquette County in Michigan, the state of Michigan. They had all the permits. The EPA came in at the last minute and said, no, we can't do it, overruling the state and local units of government unnecessarily. And it was a very bad decision. It was not based on science. And it's those type of decisions that really need to be changed. And in order to allow these large economic development projects that are going to bring billions of dollars of wealth to the Great Lakes states if we allow them to go forward.
So I guess my question is, too, you said we have a strong sulfide mining law, you know, so if this were repealed, this moratorium, I mean, would you consider any changes to that law, or you think it's good the way it is right now?
The only thing that I would look at is processes. We would not change numeric standards as far as, you know, like emission levels. Do you know what I mean?
You mean you wouldn't change, like, the level of emission standards that, you know, you would just seek to change timelines, or?
There would be no changes to, I do not anticipate changes to emission levels. In other words, those numeric standards. And, you know, we'll have to review processes and things like that to make sure that there's none that are unnecessarily long. But otherwise, I'm satisfied, generally speaking, with the numeric standards we have in place currently in Wisconsin. They're tough, they're rigorous, and they are appropriate.
Okay. And you mentioned, you know, some of the development we're seeing with car companies who have decided now to build products in the U.S. rather than build outside, say, with facilities in Mexico. Is that kind of why you would like to see this repeal now, because you see this kind of opportunity for us to, or for Wisconsin to take part in developing some of these resources nationwide?
Yeah, this opportunity has been before us for a long time if we didn't have regulatory processes that would sometimes go on for over a decade, which discourage investment. A company simply is not going to invest those dollars if there's no return for 20 or 30 years. It's been an opportunity that's been before us for a long time, and I think now is as good a time as any to be able to accept that opportunity.
Okay. Well, is there anything that I'm missing that you would like to add, Senator?
The people of the United States and Wisconsin know how to make things. And that has been set aside over the last couple decades. Part of the reason that manufacturing has moved overseas is because we've had unnecessary regulations in place. Now, we need to have appropriate regulation. We need to have good regulation. But it needs to be within an appropriate timeline. And we have a great opportunity before us here in the United States, the Great Lakes states, and Wisconsin to have enormous investment. I mean, there are numerous investments like that that could happen if we use our natural resources wisely and use them right here in the Great Lakes states.
Okay. Well, any idea when you expect to introduce this legislation to repeal that mining moratorium law?
We're going to try to do it in the next month. I can't say for sure that's going to happen, but we're looking at introducing the legislation here in the next month.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, I would say one other thing. It is important that we have some mining in the United States, and I think we can do some of it here in Wisconsin, because many of the advanced technology that we're using today, for example, some of the money-saving devices we use, like lights coming on automatically in public restrooms, you know, just various things like that, it requires components that oftentimes come from metal. And we actually are becoming better stewards of the environment by using some of these metals. And for example, my understanding is that the Toyota Prius uses 80 pounds of copper in each vehicle. I mean, it is important that we have these metals available to be able to advance the best technologies that are going to allow us to have a cleaner environment.
Well, I really appreciate it, Senator. Thanks for taking so much time to talk to me today.
Good to talk to you, Danielle.
Again, that was Hazelhurst Republican Senator Tom Tiffany talking about why he thinks Wisconsin's mining moratorium law should be repealed. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll hear from Republican Congressman Sean Duffy about a bill he introduced this week to delist the gray wolf from the endangered species list. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we hear from Northern Wisconsin Congressman Sean Duffy. This week, the Republican lawmaker put forth a bill with a bipartisan group of lawmakers from Minnesota and Wyoming to delist the gray wolf from the endangered species list. The wolf was put back on the list in December 2014 after a federal judge's ruling. The decision meant that wolves could no longer be harvested in the state. Wisconsin passed a law in recent years allowing a wolf hunt. That had been in place since 2012, and since then, Wisconsin's wolf population has grown to just under 900. Wolf conflicts have been an ongoing issue with livestock and pets. Jack Johnson with the North Central Wisconsin Cattlemen's Association says he supports any effort to delist the wolf.
And the state could start managing them and get a little control over the numbers, because right now they're expanding way more than we've got room for them.
But wolf advocates fear putting the wolf back in state hands. Blogger Rachel Tilseth is the founder of the website Wolves of Douglas County, Wisconsin.
They should be left on the endangered species list until the state of Wisconsin can show that they have plans other than hunting them.
I spoke with Congressman Duffy on Wednesday this week about why he believes the wolf should be removed from the endangered species list.
So what you see is across the northern part of our country, why you'll get a Liz Cheney and a Colin Peterson and a Sean Duffy working together to delist the gray wolves is they're having a significant impact on our economy, on our farmers, the growth of the wolf population has taken a toll on livestock, taken a toll on pets, on those families that live out in the country. And this has really been a nonpartisan issue. The Obama Fish and Wildlife Service was the one who actually delisted the gray wolf. And it was a judicial activist in their review of their case that put them back on the endangered species list. And when you look at what Wisconsin has done with its state management plan, the Fish and Wildlife Service was actually pretty thrilled with what that plan looked like and thought they were well positioned to manage the wolf population. So now this is an act of Congress to actually make sure we can delist the wolves and make sure Wisconsin can manage the wolf population in a way that allows our farmers to protect their livestock. And frankly, even if you look at our deer herd, our deer population, it's important to make sure that we maintain that herd and look at the impacts that the wolves are having on that population as well.
Okay. And, you know, I just talked to the a director with the North Central Wisconsin Cattlemen's Association, who supports any effort to delist the wolf because they feel like it's just getting out of control as far as the numbers. But then I also spoke to some wolf supporters. And what do you say to, like, tribes or wolf advocates who fear that putting it in state hands means that they'll be aggressively hunted instead of managed sustainably?
Well, I would tell you that I haven't heard any state management plans that are ones that provide for hunting of the gray wolf. That is not an option that I've seen. You've seen pretty responsible plans. And I guess to those who have concerns, I would just, again, remind people that, you know, Barack Obama's Fish and Wildlife Service is the one that analyzed this case and said that we should delist the gray wolf. And they are the ones who looked at the Wisconsin management plan and said this is a pretty good plan to actually manage the gray wolf. So this is, you know, not a open season on the gray wolf. This is just a way to make sure that our farmers can protect their herds from the wolf population.
Okay. Well, I understand that, but you are aware that there is a wolf hunt in place in Wisconsin. If it were repealed, then that would be reenacted, right?
Well, I think what we have to do is look at what is the management plan going to look like in the state. Again, President Obama, again, I think most of the progressives and liberals would say is one who they feel is looking out for wildlife and the environment, is the one who looked at the issues, his administration looked at these issues, and found that this was an appropriate move to make. And again, this was earlier in the administration. And our concern is when you have the Fish and Wildlife Service make a determination, again, after looking at our state plan and a judicial activist returning it, then you see Congress act. And Danielle, listen, you have bipartisan support for this issue. Now, in areas where they don't have a wolf population or a large wolf population, this doesn't matter to them. But in the parts of the country where this has become such a growing issue, you do have to look at how you manage the growing wolf population in a way that allows our farmers to protect their herd. This is not being done so there could be a wolf hunt. This delisting is so farmers can protect their livestock.
Okay. And so given that Republicans control Congress and the presidency, are you optimistic this will pass this year?
You know, I'm really optimistic. And again, if this was an issue or an idea that was driven based on party lines, I would be less optimistic. But this is an issue that is bipartisan, that you have Republicans and Democrats standing together. This is more of a regional issue that is bringing concern. And again, that's why Colin Peterson, a Democrat, is on this bill. It's kind of like, you know, the Great Lakes are kind of a regional issue. Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate stand together to protect and preserve the Great Lakes. You have Democrats and Republicans standing together on this issue. to make sure that their farmers can protect their livestock.
Well, I appreciate you taking time to talk to me this afternoon with your schedule, Congressman. Thank you very much.
Danielle, thank you so much. Have a good one, okay?
Again, that was Republican Congressman Sean Duffy about a bill he introduced this week with a bipartisan group of lawmakers to remove federal protections for the gray wolf. The state of Wisconsin paid around $200,000 last year to farmers and animal owners for damages from wolf attacks. That was from the year 2015. Up to 2 million gray wolves once roamed North America, according to the Humane Society of the United States. Today, roughly 5,500 wolves are thought to remain in the U.S. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll talk about a Shawamigan Bay Area group that once fought against an iron mine in northern Wisconsin. They talk about why they've now turned their attention to Enbridge pipelines. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out. Hi, and welcome back. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In our last segment, we take a look at the Pinocchi Hills Education Project. They held a series of meetings this week about Enbridge pipelines running through northern Wisconsin. The meetings came within a week after the Bad River Tribe announced it would not renew easements for Enbridge on tracts of land where the company's Line 5 pipeline runs on its way from Superior to the Straits of Mackinac. Frank Kane and Richard Kettering and Rob Ganson are with the group, and they joined me this morning to talk about why they've been holding these meetings.
The Pinocchi Hills Education Project got involved with this, Danny, because it's the same water, it's the same rights, it's the same place that the DTAC line would have devastated. And I'm thinking that the potential of a pipeline spill, it could even be worse than the mine. If the same communities that's going through, the communities in the Bed River watershed, Ashland, Iron County, same rivers, same creeks, same lakes, same streams that are threatened, that the mine threatened.
And so basically you're advocating for any awareness surrounding any major development projects that would affect the Pinocchi Hills.
Well, what the Pinocchi Hills Education Project did was try to provide as much community involvement, community education as we could. And this is just an extension of the concern for the water. And that's the thread that kind of binds this all together is the water. And when we were concerned about the mine, we did fish fries and it covered a wide area up here with fish fries and picnics and little concerts and community meetings, and we'll be doing the same thing with the concern about the pipeline as it goes through. We, spent a lot of time up at the Pinocchi Hills, walking the area. We had a camp up there along the pipeline. We want to walk the pipeline wherever we legally can do so. We'd like to set up a day or maybe 2 days, however long it would take us to do a virtual tour of the pipeline, where we can actually be live at the places where the pipeline crosses the roads in the national forests or wetlands or so forth, and bring that pipeline into people's living rooms and into the coffee shops so they can really get a visualize what the concerns are. And, of course, we'd invite the company to join us, and we'll have a letter off to them that went out last night, asking them how they might want to participate, and we're sending it up to the Canadian Enbridge office because, from what we understand, the pipeline, Line 5 ends up in Canada. Line 3 brings product into the United States, and that comes out of Canada, so it starts in Canada and ends in Canada, and we'd like to deal with the Canadian Enbridge to have them share what they do on these lines to protect the water. And also, there's some pretty serious charges that came out of Kalamazoo. Now, I had a whistleblower here that was telling us these are the problems, and that's why we're so interested in walking the pipeline to get a sense of that ourselves and find out if we have the same problems, the potential same problems here or not.
And Frank, why now? The Kalamazoo River spill happened in 2010, so why are you focusing more now on awareness?
So why is there more interest in the pipeline today than there was in the past?
Yes.
Well, part of it is the past was the past. That was, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And when the pipeline went in, I think the Line 5 has exceeded the expectations that anybody put on it. But part of it is that we have more communication today. We have more people that are really aware of how important water is and the worldwide threats to water. We finished the Pinocchio Hills project, and I think the Pinocchio Hills Education Project, the Bad River Watershed Association, worked very effectively together in really addressing the concerns of water. And here, a few short months later, we have the same problem of being concerned about the water. At least when the Pinocchio Hills Education Project started, we had a Department of Natural Resources that functioned. We no longer have a Department of Natural Resources that functions. In fact, it's kind of been downgraded to becoming a closet, and we no longer have an agency in the state of Wisconsin that's charged with protecting our resources that we own. In fact, those agencies are charged with the task of attempting to sell them off. So right now, we really don't have anyone else that's going to look at the water. And when I say look at anyone else looking at the water, working to protect the water, other than the people that live here.
Because you don't feel that the DNR and EPA would do that?
Well, I don't know that the DNR has the capacity to do that anymore. They are operating under a different set of rules and regulations than due to the changes in the mining laws and things like that.
Hey, Danny, Richard here. The city of Akron, as you know, has had concerns about the water source in Suwamaton Bay with the potential hog farm in Bayfield County. And one of those responses that the city of Akron has done, we created a source water protection plan committee to analyze what the risks are and what are the threats to our water. Now, we've got several threats, and the pipeline is one of them. Now, this committee was formed last summer, and we are hoping to come forward with a plan by the end of this year to start to implement what protections we can to ensure that Akron's municipal water supply is safe now and into the future. The other risks we have, and a pipeline spill would be predominant over all of these, but the other risk is we've got climate change, warming waters, severe storms, and there's legacy pollution on the bottom of the bay, which has all led to an increased algae growth in the bay, and we are really starting to become concerned about a potential dead zone created in Suwamaton Bay. We don't need a major oil spill on top of this.
And Rob, you've been quiet thus far. Anything that you'd like to add on why these meetings are important?
Well, I happen to live just a few miles downhill from the Enbridge line, so I have a personal perspective on it, and I have a perspective as a member of the public, too, that 60 years ago people weren't aware the way they are now. And I don't think anybody paid much attention when a foreign oil company managed to seize national forest land by eminent domain in order to make a profit for themselves, a Canadian company. That had no business happening. A 63-year-old pipeline running through the national forest when it was only engineered and designed to last for 40 years is a major concern.
Again, we've been speaking to Frank Kane, Richard Kettering, and Rob Ganson about meetings to raise awareness about Enbridge pipelines running through northern Wisconsin. Up next, we hear from Enbridge spokeswoman Jennifer Smith about the group's concerns and discussions with the Bad River Tribe about its decision to deny some easements for its Line 5 pipeline last week.
Well, I mean, we still haven't been directly contacted by the band regarding that decision. in our last meetings with them at the end of last year. That was, you know, there was no indication of us that this was coming. So we are still trying to, you know, would like to continue to try and work with the band and are trying to contact them.
Okay. Well, in addition to that, this week there was a number of meetings called pipeline awareness meetings by the Pinocchio Hills Education Project, which had, prior to this occasion, had been mostly against iron mining in Ashland and Iron counties as part of the Gogebic Taconite Project. And now they've held a series of meetings this week in the Shawamigan Bay area about Enbridge pipelines. And I'm just wondering if you've had any communication with them or your thoughts about some of these meetings that have come up in the last week.
Yeah, no, we have not had any communication with that organization. We, too, heard about them through the media reports and other channels. And so, you know, we always want to be very transparent where we work with our landowners and all of our stakeholders, want to make sure that, you know, the communities know. I think, you know, their focus right now is Line 5, our Line 5 pipeline, which originates at our Superior Terminal and runs through northern Michigan, northern Wisconsin, UP, northern Michigan, and all the way down to Sarnia. You know, Line 5 is a vital link to the energy that Midwesterners and northern Wisconsin and folks in the UP rely on. It actually carries up to 540,000 barrels per day of light crude oil, as well as natural gas liquids, which is refined into propane, which is what a number of households, you know, heat their home with. Of course, then it's also fueling our vehicles, businesses, powering industry. I mean, it really is a critical piece of energy infrastructure that's been running safely, operating safely for more than 65 years.
Okay, and I'm just curious to get your thoughts, too, on what the business climate has been like for Enbridge, because it seems like over the past year or so, we've seen a lot of opposition to projects that Enbridge has tried to put forth, whether it's been the Sandpiper pipeline that has since been delayed, or Line 3, or even loosely affiliated projects that Enbridge is a part of, such as the Dakota Access Pipeline, which got a lot of attention in the later half of last year. Do you feel like the climate towards pipelines has changed significantly in recent years? And if so, why is that in your mind?
You know, so there has been an increased awareness or heightened awareness of pipelines in general as the groups are looking at having us move to a lower carbon footprint, and, you know, the larger climate change discussion, I think, has been growing over the years, too. In terms of, you know, our stakeholders, our landowners, those that are truly live along the corridors where we have pipelines, where we're communicating with regularly, I mean, there's a lot of on-the-ground, you know, support, and that's usually the silent majority. And so, you know, again, we want to work with all of the stakeholders. We want to respond to concerns. We, you know, go out there where hosting our own meetings and want to educate the public on these pipelines. But they are critical infrastructure. All of us that live here in, whether it's Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Midwest, we're all using the products every day that originate as crude oil on Enbridge pipelines. So there in Wisconsin, there's one refinery. Enbridge transports 100% of the crude oil that goes into that refinery and then is processed and not only used, you know, and turned into gasoline, but also you've got lubricants, you have asphalt. When you look at the refineries in Minnesota, it's 80% of the crude oil that they're refining is being transported. And when you look at the Midwest as a whole, it's more than 70 or 75%. So our goal, our responsibility is to transport this crude oil, get it to the refineries safely. At the same time, we put a lot of effort into our public awareness program and in making sure that we are working with our stakeholders and educating them on all of the different things that we are doing to make the pipeline safe.
And safety is one of the issues that has been brought up as a part of these series of pipeline awareness meetings, at least in the Shawangan Bay area. And they have actually been hosting a speaker who is a former Enbridge employee that raised questions about Enbridge pipeline safety procedures, at least as it related to the Kalamazoo River spill. And my question, I guess, for you is, as a company, how difficult is it, you know, after a high-profile event like that where you have a major spill and are trying to move forward from that and regain the public's trust? I mean, do you feel like you're continually paying for the sins of the past?
Well, so let me, first of all, let me make a clarification that the person that they have speaking did not work for Enbridge. He did work for a short time for a contractor who was brought on to work at the Marshall Remediation Project. And so he was there. My understanding was, you know, there was some employment issues that were handled through the courts there. But so, you know, in terms of the incident itself, that incident, it was definitely the most significant environmental incident that we've ever experienced. It had, you know, a great impact on the people of Marshall and there in Michigan, as well as, you know, those of us here at Enbridge. It was a transformative moment for the company. And, you know, and so, yes, you know, since that time, Enbridge has spent about $1.2 billion into that remediation project. There were countless number of hours that went into that response with local officials, state officials, government officials, Enbridge, contractors. You know, in 2014, it was declared by the state and the federal officials that, you know, the river has now been restored, it's been reopened. And so, you know, since that time, Enbridge has made significant improvements across our entire system. One, that particular line has now been fully replaced. Line 6B is what we refer to that as. But also, we've invested over $5 billion across our enterprise on maintenance, inspection programs, increasing the amount that goes into the research and development of our inline inspection tools. And so, you know, we have a responsibility to educate people and let them know that, one, when that incident happened, Enbridge took responsibility. We responded and we worked with our regulators, our local officials. We worked with the communities to make sure that we restored that river and that, you know, that we did what was right. And, you know, now if you can go on either the, you know, Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, or there are a number of very public documents and videos, and even on our own website at enbridge.com/Marshall, there are a number of testimonials. If you talk to a number of the residents of that community there that was most severely impacted, you know, while nobody ever wanted that to happen, at this point, you know, there are many people that would say that the river is restored and looks cleaner than it was, you know, prior to.
Well, and another part of the investments that you've made, as you've said, this $5 billion in safety and technological procedures, I think a part of the question related to that is how that's been spread across all of Enbridge projects. More specifically, in recent months, we've seen discussions about Line 5, and I saw recently this week that there's some new business group that has formed to get out information about, like, the age of Line 5. And so, you know, what do you say to people who are questioning the status of the pipelines, how old they are, and how they're maintained as part of the safety?
Sure. And so, you know, and we call that fitness for service. And every pipeline, you know, we have a very aggressive maintenance and integrity program. Again, inline inspections on all of the pipelines occur regularly. There are a number of different factors that go into determining the, I will say, lifespan or useful life of the pipelines. And so Line 5 was built in the 1950s. It was, you know, top quality steel that was put into that, the top quality coating at the time. Coating is a very significant factor in the terms of pipeline lifespan because of, you know, that's protecting the steel from the environment and external stressors. And so we are very confident in Line 5. We've run tools through there. You know, Line 5 does cross the Straits of Mackinac. That particular crossing right there, Line 5, which is one pipeline through most of its route, actually turns into two smaller diameter pipelines that are seamless, which means that it was a solid rod of steel that was bored through. For those pipelines, it runs at a fraction of the pressure that that segment was built to run at, and there is, you know, again, that section itself even has a more aggressive maintenance project that includes, you know, using autonomous underwater vehicles that, you know, we've worked with Michigan Tech on, and there's a number of different weather buoys and huge investment there. So, again, Line 5 is safely and reliably delivering this energy. It has been for years, and we're very confident that it will continue to remain and operate safely for many years to come.
Again, you were just listening to Enbridge spokeswoman Jennifer Smith about the company's ongoing efforts to maintain the safety of its pipelines. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. I'm Danielle Kading, and Hear Me Out will not be heard next Friday due to coverage of President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration. But we'll return the following week with James Anderson to talk about planning for the grassroots lobbying effort Superior Days, and bring you an interview with Stefan Witherspoon, the new president of the Duluth chapter of the NAACP. I'm Danielle Kading, and thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.